Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 209 featuring Colin Aguirre. And I am going to talk about Colin in a second because he's an amazing person. He's the composer on Construct. And I'll get into that for a second. But I've got Melissa.
Hello, listeners.
Hello, Melissa.
It's been a while.
It has been a while. Melissa, tell me. We've got an announcement coming up. So what's going on?
I need a fanfare.
Yeah.
Total Chaos Strikes Back.
Yay!
So our big conference we held last May in Sofia in Bulgaria.
Yeah.
Was incredible. We talked about it loads at the time and you got some great podcasts out of it.
I did.
Well, we're back again. We've just set the dates for this year in May again.
Yeah.
It's going to be 16th to 18th. So we've got 3 days this time instead of the two.
Okay.
And our event page has just gone live on our website. So if anyone's interested in coming along to Sofia and seeing a load of wonderful CG related talks and masterclasses, they should check out chaosgroup.com/total-chaos.
Right.
Or just Google Total Chaos Conference and you'll find it.
Yeah.
Tickets are on sale. The super early bird tickets have just been released. There's only been a handful and they're going to go like hotcakes, I'm sure. So get in there quick and get your ticket.
Great. Now, you mentioned it was 3 days instead of two. And why is that? Do we add some extra stuff?
Well, we had a comment. We had several people commenting last time that they'd booked up to see the masterclasses, but they were all happening at the same time as the other wonderful talks. So,
they were missing out on the talks.
Yeah, so we've split up this year, which makes a lot of sense. So we've got the masterclasses. If you want to attend one of those, there's three different ones to choose between. They're noted on the tickets page. You can read a bit more info about them there. They're happening on the 16th. So that's the May the 16th. And then we have 2 days of conference talks following that on the 17th and 18th.
Great. So people who register for masterclasses will be able to go to all the talks because there's no conflict this year, which is great.
Yes.
Wonderful. 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 So that's great. And I'm really excited about Total Chaos. I will be there. I will be recording, I'm sure, many podcasts while I'm there. We have a few speakers announced on the website, but there are many, many, many more to come.
There are a lot in the works, as you can imagine. Yeah. We've got 50. Plus, speakers that we're trying to get confirmation on at the moment.
Right.
May is a little way off, but some have confirmed already, which is wonderful. And there's a lot more that will be coming in the coming days, if not weeks.
Yep.
So keep your eye on the website for those.
Yeah, that's a good excuse to go check the website every now and then to see who's
And you can sign up for email updates, actually.
Oh, great.
So we'll be shouting out about the new people as they're announced, and the full schedule will be coming out as well. So get your 45% off
while
you can, because I can tell you now that we've got some amazing people in the works. It'll be well worth it. It's even bigger and better than last year.
That's awesome. That's awesome. All right. Well, that's what we got for Total Chaos. There's other things also on our software side of things coming up, but nothing that I can announce right now. So I'm going to go right into Colin and talk about some of his work. Colin is a composer, which I think is very unique for this podcast to hear his point of view about making the score to a short, specifically to Construct. And this is a big deal, not only because he's a really amazing composer, but he's actually won not one, not two, but 12 independent film awards for the score of Construct. Can you believe that, Melissa?
That's incredible.
Yeah, 12. I mean, and these are not small ones. These include the New York Film Awards, the LA Film Shorts, London Independent Film Awards. I mean, these are some big awards that he's won for the score of Construct. And it's actually a really complicated thing to write the score to a movie or to a short in this case. And what he did for Construct is to actually give us the equivalent score that you would get for a big feature film and deviates from it experimentally in the same way that we did in CG. He experimented a lot with dubstep in a part of the fight sequence, which is a lot more complicated than you think. It's not just a bunch of beeps and blops that people seem to be saying about that stat. It's actually an extremely complicated process to make that score. So it's really, really interesting.
He did. He joined you for the talk at Nauman College.
He did. In fact, yeah, we were going to all talk together. And so it was Kevin Margot and Darren Ross and I, and then Colin joined us as well. And then as he started talking about all of the score stuff, I said, you've got to have you on this podcast, because I think people really need to take into account the importance of score when they're making a short film or an animation or anything of that nature. And you can't just say, I like this music and throw it on top, which is what a lot of people do, right? Mm-hmm. It actually has to be motivated by the action in a much more specific way. And Colin looks into that. And I've learned that, you know, when I was working with my good friend Alex Smith, who does a lot of the stuff that we do for our
showreels.
Showreels, yes. Yeah, he's great. And so music is so, so important to getting the mood right. But Colin really, really thinks about it in a really great way.
Fascinating.
Yeah. Really, and I think it's important for people to know this. So it's not just really cool to see Colin and hear Colin come on and talk about it, but also learn from him the importance of music and score when you're actually doing a short film. So it was a really interesting podcast. All right. Anything else that we need to do talk about, Melissa? You excited about our new office is all getting redone, right?
Well, this is my first time in the new podcast layout.
Yeah.
So we've got, you know, obviously I have to describe this for the listeners, but we've got a huge new lamp that's about half the size of the ceiling. Yeah. And it matches our new logo that we've got up.
Yes.
The CG Garage logo.
Thank you, Melissa, also. For those of you who have noticed, we've rebranded CG Garage, and Melissa was championing that along with Augie in our office in Sofia, mm-hmm. who redesigned the Chaos, the CG Garage logo. I love it. He did
a
great job.
Refresh all around. So we've got new look online, new look in the actual room.
Yep.
Comfy chairs. I might stay here for the rest of the day.
Yeah, yeah. The only thing that's missing that I'm really looking forward to, and this is Kristen who's bringing it in, is we're getting a custom-made podcast table.
Yeah.
And it'll be here in a couple of weeks, and I can't wait to have it. It's just going to make this place
awesome.
We'll
have to do a blog post about a table.
Oh, yeah. We're going to have to see pictures, everything. It'll be great. All right. Thanks a lot, guys. Hopefully, you will enjoy this fantastic podcast with Colin Aguirre.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has
This one has 200 episodes, so.
Wow. How many years did it take you for 200?
4 years.
Holy crap.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It's fun, though.
Man, it makes me feel so, my productive. It makes me feel so inefficient. You get so much done in 2 years. You get, like, all this other stuff done besides podcast.
Well, all right, but you've done some amazing things, Colin.
But you do that like in addition to podcasts.
I guess the key for me when I was going to do podcasts was to say not really worry about, like, see how much I can do with the least amount of my time.
How much you can do with the least amount of your time.
Right.
Okay.
So therefore,
wow.
I've already started recording, just so you know.
Oh, you didn't tell me this.
I also don't edit the podcasts.
Oh, okay.
So therefore, it's pretty easy. I only edit something if there's something, I said something that I shouldn't have.
So I guess you have to keep in all the swearing. You can't sell this to Disney or anything.
No, I can't, but okay. My listeners don't seem to care.
Cool. Fine.
I can also, you know, if there's something you said that you don't want, I can take that out.
Ah, nice. Okay, cool.
But it's fine. But I, first of all,
yeah.
You just sent me an email today. You got two more awards?
Two more. Yeah.
So 5 awards you've gotten so far.
Yeah.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, I don't know.
We should clarify that these awards were for the soundtrack of Construct, right?
Yeah. It's the score.
The score.
I don't even luck out getting good parking spots, so I have to wait forever for an elevator. I end up taking the stairs. So if I get like an award, that's pretty good. And you know what? These are winnings too. They're not nominations. So
yeah, it was really good. I think one of the things I thought that was interesting as part of the story of making of this short is that this whole thing was experimental, both, you know, from the technology to the creativity to everything.
Right.
And I think that you embraced that part of it in what you were doing as a score, and you were trying experimentation in this, right?
You know, to be honest, I'm even more of an experimenter. I'm kind of like a crazy experimenter to the point of I'll try things that are obscure, and I'm not afraid of it, of things sounding obscure.
Okay.
Obscure and experimental and very, very far away from mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say, when it came to Construct and understanding what our objective was, the mission was to for Kevin to be seen in a good light,
okay,
and a specific light, you know, as the director of a tentpole film,
mm-hmm,
in a world that makes films from, well, not to pigeonhole them, but you know, there is kind of like a resident formula for these movies,
mm-hmm,
and for Kevin to be seen as able of containing ability to, mm-hmm, pull that off,
right?
And therefore, for his team, by that implication, for his team to also be able to pull off exactly what that formula is set out to pull off. There is a fair amount of experimentation. There's also the aspect that what I'm trying to go for in the score has to be done within the confines of of my own studio.
Okay.
And the model that these formulas take after have literally millions and hundreds of thousands of dollars and months of time,
right,
invested in those score models.
Sure.
So there was an experimentation angle from, you know, what I had to do technically.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, my model was to, and this is very related to the, I don't know if that's my
the
phone.
Line noise.
Oh, okay.
It's not in the recording.
Okay, good. I thought it was from my phone.
Yeah.
My model was to, you know, put whatever executive in the comfort zone.
Okay.
And there are certain sections that take after iconic sci-fi scores. And then there's that one section, you know, where the represent those robots.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the dubstep part. That's the part where I say, goodbye models, you know, we're wheels up. And
right,
we're going to do something extremely original. And yeah, so that's the most, it went away. after I took this away. That's the most experimental part, but for the most part, the experimentation came from the dubstep stuff and, the technological stuff.
Okay. Well, explain a little, because I remember you and I and Kevin and Darren, we all were on a panel at Noman, and you were talking about some of that stuff you're doing in dubstep. So dubstep is a very interesting thing. I think some people think they know what that's about, but explain the challenges of doing dubstep and what it takes to actually make a score like that and why it's different.
Firstly, you know, dubstep, paying respect to dubstep, is kind of like a subculture. It's kind of like a subgenre.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, like all of these things, they have their 15 minutes and then they fade away.
Sure.
But I will say, when it comes, even if we have to revive this concept and make a score, you know, make a feature, you know, 3 years from now, Using dubstep in this context of construct will still make sense. I really think it was really good solution to to our visuals, you know. Technically though, dubstep is it's very technical, and you know, most of these things are hard when these subgenres are in their birth stage, because the mainstream music technology manufacturers don't have what we call presets yet.
Okay.
Presets are when they figure out, the people making these technologies, they figure out all the many, many steps that it takes to produce a dubstep sound.
Okay.
And they put it into a box, they record it, they put it into a box, and at the command of one key, you can hit one key and it produces those many stages that would take weeks. And like, you know, instantly. So right now that isn't available.
How do you just so people have an idea, because I think what would be great is for people to sort of understand the intricacies of the process. So how do you make a dubstep sound? It's actually fairly intricate, right?
Yeah. It's fairly intricate. Mostly dubstep sounds, they morph, like a 2 second melody morphs, and it goes, you know, like it morphs, the sounds change, and what you're actually hearing there, if you were to break it down, is you're hearing several stages of filters of a synth that are opening and closing. Every millisecond of that needs to be automated in the computer. You might hear a lot of compression. You might hear a sound moving through vocoders and different, many, many different filters. It might start out as one synth note that is programmed to begin with. That is, you know, you start from scratch.
So just a single note.
Just a single note. Then that note, within a synth is programmed. So you're doing a lot of real-time processing. So there might you're manipulating what we call LFOs or low filter oscillators. You're manipulating other filters that are routed through. It gets kind of crazy. It looks like a gigantic patchboard of one thing wired to another thing, which produces another sound, and then you wire that to another thing. So you can take the sum of that output, take it and move it through another filter independently, take the result of that, move that through another filter independently.
So multi-layered filtering.
Multi-processing for sure. And that might only produce about a third of a second, to half of a second, to 3/4 of a second of usable material.
Okay.
And then you do the same thing to get the next 3/4 of a second.
Right.
And then if you need to go back so that the first 3/4 doesn't match the second, you know, you alter that. You do that for days until you have a whole melody. So that's basically. It just takes a long time, you know.
Yeah.
In that time, if you were just doing regular orchestral score and nothing else, which is also pretty audio's task,
right?
You could have finished a whole score in that time,
right? But it's kind of amazing to sort of like manually filter out an entire melody in dubstep, right?
Yeah, you know what? I tell you, it is, and you know, you have to be probably certifiably insane to go after a solution like that. But, you know, in the beginning, it was just the theory, because when I saw those robots, I was like, this is perfect for that. And then I started this process and I was like, I am crazy. Lock me up. But then in my test, I was like, oh, hang on a second. This is really working.
Right.
I need to work
do
these.
This. Right.
And then 3 weeks later, I was like, oh, wait, hold on a second. Am I crazy or is it working? And then 4 weeks later, it'd be like, oh, you know what? It is really working. I need to put myself through this.
Right. And that was that you sort of orchestrated that for the action sequence, right? For the fight sequence was that really where that took place, and in a very unusual, hard way. I mean, it enhanced that action in a way that I think that's very unique, right?
Right. Yeah. You know, if this was a larger piece, if this was a larger film, mm-hmm. and we were able to give those themes a little more exposition, mm-hmm. I would have elements of that elsewhere. But I saved it for the most indicative of the scenes of the construct world.
Right.
Mainly because I wanted to put the audience in a sense of, you know, familiarity, mm-hmm. you know, I want to say to them, you know, you're home. If you like sci-fi,
right.
And you enjoy movies in this genre, you're home. You can, right. You can kick back and relax.
Yeah. It was really, really good.
Thanks, man.
I think it's unique. And I think that, you know, I don't really know of much dubstep that's done as part of a score.
Yeah, you know, scores are the one of the things that makes scores hard is that, you know, you get a deadline and you got to accomplish like all that on a deadline.
Right.
So why would you make it hard on yourself?
And right.
There's so many things to think about. Why would you throw in like a bag of wrenches?
Right. But I think there's a lot of people that are basically out there. What I'd love for people to do who are young people who want to make a short of some kind or thinking about doing it, they'll just think about ripping off some sound, some music that they like, and then just trying to shoehorn that into it and make that part of it. And that's not obviously what you did, right? That wasn't a mandate that you were given. Not say, oh, make it sound like this, make it sound like that. There is a process that you go through when you're making a score, right? And I think it would be great for people to understand. It's like, okay, if you're going to make a score about your short, you have to consider all the different layers of that score in the same way that you consider the entire narrative of the piece that you're making. And you did that. You know, obviously there's dialogue, et cetera, but you did that as part of the character, and that's not necessarily uncommon. It's done often in scores where you actually have themes of music per character that weave in and out as that character is the important part of the plot. But you did it in a very interesting and very subtle way. So it explains like what's your thought process. Like if I'm Kevin and I just made this short and I hand it to you, it's like, how do you go from there? What's your recommendation? If I'm a young guy making a short and I say, I need a score for this, what's the best way to think about it or to approach this?
Right. Okay. This is one of those questions I'll answer really well on the trip back home in the car.
No, you're not.
That always happens to me. Let me see. Let me try my best. I think, firstly, as the composer speaking subjectively, mm-hmm. I will tell you a big part of this comes from kind of like my philosophy.
Okay.
And my philosophy is that this is my movie and I own it. And to pretend that, you know, the entire 8 months or 2 years or 1 year, whatever was invested to get the film to the day I saw it, like I kind of take it upon myself to believe that I invested all that time.
Okay.
And so there's so much that rests on this film. And if it was my film and I owned it, you know, this is not the time to drop the ball. This is the time to really punch the stakes up, you know, to bring it, to make it even more than it is in its present state.
Right.
And I own this film. It's my responsibility.
Right.
So firstly, there's that. And that, I think, makes me...
Well, that could put you in the emotional state, right? That makes sure you're invested into this, right?
Yeah. The afterburners switch on, like, really, really quick. Mm-hmm. There's also this aspect that, you know, I there's a scene in Romeo and Juliet where, you know, Romeo says, you know, I'm so lovesick, you know, mm-hmm. I cannot stop thinking about this girl. And that is exactly me too. Like, you know, I wake up thinking about it. I go to sleep thinking about it. I'm humming things in the car. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm in a constant state of complete and deep infatuation. I'm submerged in this state of infatuation for this movie. So yeah, together with the ownership, you know,
right.
it's a fairly lovesick situation.
Right.
Now, if you're Kevin and you want to, you know, get the best score for your film, I would say, you know, I was writing this book for filmmakers to help them get the best out of their scoring department.
Awesome.
And I did a lot of research, and I found that there were four things that someone needed.
Yeah.
The first thing is what I broadly term as talent. You know, you got to find someone that, you know, that from the surface at this point might seem like you need to just find a talented person. Mm-hmm. But you need to find someone that really loves your film, mm-hmm. you know, I think, and someone that has the ability to convert their ideas into tangible score.
Okay.
So that means that someone that has a facility or a studio of some kind, even if it's in their bedroom, to bring whatever ideas that they have or they're gestating to a tangible music file that can be mixed into the film.
Right.
So the studio is an aspect of it. And the talent is such an elastic quality. It can overcome so many other things.
Right.
The other thing is the filmmaker needs to provide guidance, which is something that you can't really direct us music because there's so many aspects to music. Mm-hmm. Countless. I can't even list them. They take too long. But there's so many aspects that it's almost more intelligent, efficient solution to guide, provide, you know, answer questions that a composer might have, mm-hmm. And just nudge them into the lane that fits your vision, you know?
Sure.
And with Kevin and me, that seemed to be on the same page right from the start.
Okay.
We just verified that as we went through the process, but we were lucky enough to, like, be on the same page, and I'm thankful for that. Mm-hmm. The other thing is budget. And this is independent film. You know, you don't have the luxury of a budget. And you know, neither Kevin, neither will any other independent filmmaker.
Sure.
But I would say, outside of the construct process, I would recommend that your budget be outcome oriented, and by that I mean you settle on a budget that will result in an audience experience that you desire, and anything that puts the audience out of that envelope is undesirable. So if you look at, you know, what a like Spider-Man 3 or Terminator 2, for example, mm-hmm. was rumored to have like a $2 million budget, or
on
Spider-Man
3
on the score.
Right.
I don't know what the split was between the composer's fee and the production fee, mm-hmm. but it's, you know, I saw this budget once that said it was $2 million or something like that. Mm-hmm. So obviously no independent production is going to have that.
Sure.
And also there's this rumor, not rumor, there's this kind of floating idea that a music budget should be 2% of, or 4%, whatever it happens to be, of your total budget.
Okay.
But if you think about that, 4% of a small indie budget might not be enough to put your audience in that, in that area of comfortability and believability.
Sure.
So if you end up making a film that doesn't accomplish what you want to accomplish with your audience, really, it's not going to accomplish what you want.
Okay.
Right? Because you want that film to protrude through competition.
Right.
And to be a calling card and be a demonstration of what you can do. So, you know, just enable the composer to produce the same outcome as what you intend the audience to experience. And lastly, I would say time is the big thing. Without time, you can't really gestate all the talent, the ideas, the budget, and the guidance. You can't really, bring that to fruition.
Mm-hmm.
And also, keeping things relative, you know, like on big films, like films that are nominated for Oscars and stuff like that. I've seen films take like 18 months for scoring. That's a year and a half. On Pixar movies, you know, they take very long.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, you can do a whole feature score in a month or, you know, 2 weeks sometimes.
Right.
But I'm just trying to give you the range of examples, you know?
Sure.
And also, so in the world of construct and also for a lot of independent productions, the reason why time is important is because let's say you don't have a real orchestra or you don't have all these assistants or synth programmers to like take care of one part of the score.
Mm-hmm.
And you only have the money for one composer who is very dedicated. That's, you know, you're not paying the person very much. You know, they don't have any other help. It's just a one man, one woman, one person band.
Mm-hmm.
That person has to program everything. So they're compensating for not hiring an orchestra
mm-hmm.
by programming every move of the orchestra.
Right.
So time is really important. And so those four aspects of budget, time, guidance, and talent, you know, those are elastic and they respond to whatever your situation is.
Right.
But yeah, more or less, you know, Kevin did all four of these in some kind of aspect, you know, mm-hmm. in some kind of way that made sense, that really enabled us. Yeah.
Sure. Well, I do remember when, you know, because I was, you know, part of the production on it. I was one of the producers on it. The score was taking longer than I expected, which is, you know, the result speaks for itself. But I was like, wow, why is it taking so long for this score? And this is something I needed to learn, right? I needed to be part of that process. I hadn't done it that way, right? So there's a lot of, I mean, and there is so much, and this happens a little bit in visual effects, but I'm sure it's even worse for people that are making scores, is that a lot of times when people are making an edit or trying to going through their process, whatever, they'll put in temp music or temp score that ends up becoming like so familiar that they're like, no, just make it sound like what we already did. That's got to be tough, right?
Yeah.
Because it'll change. Like if you did what you really wanted to do, it probably could change the entire mood of what they're working on.
To be honest, I like temp score. I will temper that by telling you what I do with temp score. The reasons I like, well, okay. So when I watch a movie for the first time, mm-hmm. I politely request that I'm given a version of the movie without any temp score.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really want to, I want
you don't want it to influence you, right?
I don't want it to, not only that, but I, you know, I'm really trying to, I'm approaching the film kind of like, kind of like a pediatrician is approaching a baby. I want the, like the baby can't really articulate, you know, that a specific medical issue, but I want to diagnose the issue for myself.
Okay.
You know, I want to know, like, I want to examine and understand exactly what it is. I don't want to be led, and I don't want to think that it's another ailment when
right.
it's really specific, you know? So I definitely want to deal with my film organically and naturally. I want it to lead as opposed to anything else leading, even me. That's number one. But the temp score is really helpful because if you look at it, in the end, it makes my job kind of easier because temp scores lend a tempo to the cut that an editor feeds off.
Mm-hmm.
And that tempo is very, very useful because when I'm putting another piece of music on top, the nature of the piece of music, the instrumentation might be completely different.
Right, and that's not going to have the tempo that the editor intended, right?
No. It can have either have the same tempo or it can have divisions of the tempo. It can be a little quicker, but for any piece of music requires a fixed rhythm.
Okay.
That doesn't move. You know, I don't know how to explain this in detail and quickly. Let me see here. So, a tempo provides. Visual events
yes.
that happen in a fixed interval of time.
Okay.
And that fixed interval of time imparts a tempo. So when you're writing a piece of music, all pieces of music have events along the piece of music in fixed intervals of time.
Okay.
If you raise the tempo, the distance between each event quickens.
Okay.
Like, for example, what I'm saying is, like, let's take the most basic thing. Like, if you're writing a club track, okay, it goes doos, 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 doos,
right.
and you raise it, it goes doos, 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 right?
Right.
So the thing is that if that was your temp music mm-hmm. and you edited on that, and I didn't know that, I'm still able to write another piece of music that can fit along those tracks, you know, like let's say it takes like a 3/4 of a second between each beat. Mm-hmm. I can still put another piece of music on there. But when there's no temp track, there isn't that fixed interval. So it might be doof, 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 doof. You know, like,
right.
like those events might be uneven,
mm-hmm.
and a composer, it's hard to put a piece of music on there.
Right.
So that's another thing that the temp music gives you. And then if a composer's in a hurry, if I'm in a hurry, and you refer to the temp track, I mean, there's most of your solution. You can,
yeah, it's true.
You know? So if I have to do something in a week,
right.
You know, like I can just say, oh, you know, there's no time to experiment.
Right.
Let's see what they actually meant and feed off that.
Right, right, right. Well, I think there's, you know, the emotional part of writing a score or bonding with things, it becomes very, very important. And the personal nature of it, the things that I think were very powerful for Construct is the emotional aspect that was involved. I've seen the movie, you know, many, many, many times, obviously. But I still feel the very strong emotions that come from watching it, especially, you know, towards the end. And I don't think I would have felt it if I didn't have the guidance from the score. You know what I mean?
Mm.
There is obviously that break when the action is happening that is not separate necessarily from the rest, but there is a you know, high adrenaline moment and yeah. then a strong emotional release and cathartic feeling towards the end. I mean, it is a tragic story, right? In a lot of ways, in a true sense of Greek tragedy, right?
Yeah.
So you have that cathartic feeling at the end. They're like, oh, and then, you know, it's just, it's big. It's a big, strong feeling that is punctuated by the very unusual music that you added yet again, interesting experiment thing for the credit sequence. So the credits is a different score that still follows the same logic, but it has a different feeling to it. It made the credits even like you have to finish watching the credits. You can't just go, okay, that's because the credits continue like this journey that you've gone through that emotional cathartic feeling to like, now is your release and you're like, you know, disengaged. It was really interesting. Tell me a little bit about the end credits and how that felt to you.
Thanks, man. You're the best. Thank you. man, my ego is going to expand. The credit sequence. I come back to this thing of like really falling in love with this movie, you know? And I had so many ideas that are just, you know, still unused.
Mm-hmm.
And the credit sequence, I thought, you know, that's a good place to put one of these ideas. So when I was a kid and writing music, I was one of those composers that I revered. I enjoyed listening to, enjoyed playing, was Bach, you know, J.S. Mm-hmm. Bach. And, you know, what a extraordinary mind that guy had. You know, very rarely will you find those ideas and that output paralleled by other mortals. Mm-hmm. One of the things that he did very, very quickly, too, because he had to produce music every week. But this guy somehow, he would invent these games and invent these challenges for himself. One of them were palindromes, and he would write a piece of music that you could read backwards on paper from the last bar going all the way to the first,
mm-hmm.
and it would be the same piece of music. And I thought that was a fun challenge when I was a kid, and I would write these palindromes. And so I would always theorize, you know, how to make this more challenging.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that wasn't available in Bach's time was to take a piece of music that was recorded and then flip the recording to play backwards.
Which would sound very different, right?
Yeah.
Because you can't make a backwards violin sound manually, right?
Yeah, the violin is a very, very hard one to if you were playing that backwards, it would be very hard to reproduce the same.
You don't go. It's like inhaling a trumpet. You can't.
yeah. With percussive instruments,
mm-hmm.
It's a little easier. Like if you're doing drums, for example,
sure. You know,
playing that backwards. And there are some people who theorize that a piano is a percussion instrument.
But it is kind of a string instrument, too.
it is a string instrument, too.
Yeah.
There's this composer, Bartok, who I'm a big fan of, mm-hmm. Who believed that it was, that he would treat it, at least, as a percussive instrument, as a mm-hmm. percussion instrument. So that's kind of where I was importing from. So I wrote this piano piece,
mm-hmm.
Palindrome, so it's played backwards.
Right.
From back to front, plays the same. And then in the second half of the piece, the audio is reversed.
So it is a palindrome on its own, and then so it's an auditory palindrome, you play it as a palindrome, and then you literally make it another palindrome by just reversing the audio.
Yeah.
So it's basically, it's the same thing repeated four times?
Yeah, same thing with beer four times. Yeah.
No. Wow. Interesting.
Or lazy. I don't know.
No. Well, it's cool. It definitely has a very interesting sound the whole time, you know, and it's just piano pieces are also very interesting for sure.
Yeah. And, you know, the thing is, like, you know, someone asked me to write a piece of music for a film that they spent so many years doing, so many other people have worked on. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to add some meaning. I want to make a contribution to it and make, you know, all the work of all those other people worthwhile.
Sure.
You know, make everyone as a team feel that, you know, this is something special and,
right,
you know, do something with it, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's really, yeah. And yeah, it definitely did that. But you mentioned, you know, listening to Bach as a kid. What were some of your influences in music as a child? What were some of the things that got you into music? What were?
I'm going to betray myself because I have such a bad memory that I probably won't be able to list all of them. But I have like musical parents, so I started this when I was like two. So there's a lot of music. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you know, Bach and Brahms, a little bit of Mozart, not that much Mozart, but, you know, the obscure people, Paul Hindemith, Lenny Bernstein, I love Leonard mm-hmm. Bernstein. Who else? Bartok, definitely. Mm-hmm. Some Shostakovich.
Right.
All the great Russian composers, you know, the great Russian composers, really, they've lent so much of a contribution to our modern film scoring. Prokofiev, you know, especially Prokofiev, Tchaikovsky, all the ballets, Wagner's operas and stuff. But then on the other hand, you know, there's industrial music. Like obscure stuff like Kraftwerk or really obscure stuff like this German industrial band called Einstürt Neubauten that no one is going to know.
Okay.
Nine Inch Nails.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I spent countless hours dissecting every technique of Trent Reznor.
There's some very complicated music out there that they wrote, you know?
And, you know, it's not dissimilar, his process of moving a sound through a myriad of electronic processing.
Sure. No, absolutely. Yeah.
Same thing, right, as dubstep. Rockabilly stuff, Elvis, you know, of course, Beatles. You know, real stupid stuff like Engelbert Humperdinck and Tom Jones.
Sure.
You know, the Donny Osmond.
Right.
You know, oldies. You know, Skrillex, which is dubstep.
Right.
And, you know, also, I grew up all over the world, so a lot of world music.
Yeah.
I grew up on a lot of Bollywood films, but a lot of Arab music. I grew up in the Middle East as well.
Yeah.
Stuff that, you know, oh, and I don't necessarily look at the names of things. I try to not let the name or the brand of a piece of music affect me.
Right.
So I try to only
listen to it as it music and not try to think about it that way.
Because I want a reputable bad band or a bad artist I want to be receptive to a good idea that they have. So
sure.
I'd make it a habit not to listen, to read the label. So like, you know, like stuff from Northern Africa, like from some French artists from Algeria or, you know, Egyptian music, Saudi Arabian music, mm-hmm. Russian stuff. I grew up on a lot of Russian cartoons.
Sure. Some interesting experimental music. I haven't, you know, from Israel that's coming out is really interesting as well that I've heard.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. The Israeli musical education is like top notch.
Yeah. There's something very interesting coming out of there that I, you know, and again, I don't want to label it as Israeli. It's just that suddenly like, that's interesting.
No, they've got a rich tradition.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
And a lot of it doesn't get the amount of exposure that it really needs to.
Sure. Yeah, I agree.
there's a lot of Jewish choral music that is just genius and so beautiful.
Right.
I listen to some of that stuff. It's in Hebrew and stuff, but mm-hmm. but I get the translations and really, really beautiful stuff.
Yeah. It was interesting. I kind of go on a few tangents, but I want to go on another one because I've used this analogy before in terms of music and architecture, in terms of styles. If you were driving around here in the Hayden Corridor area and you've mm-hmm. seen all the funky buildings that are up here.
Oh, yeah, right? They're really cool.
And those are all were part of a movement in the 80s called the Deconstructivist
architecture movement.
Right?
Yeah.
So I sort of identify three key people that sort of started that. The most famous one is obviously Frank Gehry, but Eric Owen Moss, who does a lot of the buildings here, and the other one is Tom Main from Morphosis. But in the early days of deconstructivism, it was people hated it.
Right.
Hated it. It was harsh and offensive in some cases in a lot of interesting ways. And then now everyone looks at the Disney Concert Hall and say, what right. an amazing piece
exactly.
of architecture.
Yeah.
It's from the same cloth.
Right? Yeah.
So the way that I looked at it and I try to – the people look at it, I said deconstructivism is a beautiful thing. And if it wasn't for its origin story, you wouldn't be having this thing that now is popular, right? So I loved electronic music as a kid because I went to a French school and Jean-Michel Jarre was very famous in that time.
Yeah, nice.
So
yeah.
I listened to a lot of Oxygène and stuff like that. But then,
nice.
Then there was, when I was in college, early college, that's how old I was, is when techno was starting to become more popular, like sort of Detroit techno and that type of stuff. And that was famously not liked by a lot of people, right? Mm. It was certain kinds of people liked it, right?
Yeah.
But then electronic music started to evolve in a way that gave it more complexity and refinement, I find. And then, soundtracks from movies like Trainspotting would have like Underworld in there. And it was like, this is amazing. I love it. It's like, well, if it wasn't for some of the stuff that happened in Detroit techno, you wouldn't necessarily get to the
right.
underworld
yeah, yeah,
of the world,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And so I see that evolution of architecture and music. I find them – and interestingly, that's around the same time, right? Because dubstep
right.
was happening – I mean, sorry, not dubstep. Techno was happening in kind of the mid-80s is when it started coming out.
Right.
And then – all of the other stuff towards the 90s started to become much more interesting and complex. And I don't want to say that the other stuff wasn't valid. I think it's really valid. But I think it's interesting how music evolves and our tastes become either evolve with it or become accustomed to it. What do you think how our musical tastes change and how does it affect how you think of things?
There's like a magic to that. It's more of a sociological issue, I think, a sociological question, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Certain things catch on. And I'm sure of so many things that deserve artistic respect and awe
right.
that don't catch on that maybe
yes.
should, what's
or sometimes
on?
They catch on later, right? Like movies
yeah.
that happens all the time, right?
Yeah.
Like Blade Runner was a flop.
Yeah. Star Trek.
Yeah.
You're right. I don't know, but it's interesting. There is this theory in academia that a lot of ideas in music formed in like an academic incubation period almost.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. That's a good way to
say
it.
So, for example, minimalism is a stage from the 60s and 70s that
yep.
started with people like Steve Reich. I don't know if you ever...
Mm-hmm.
heard of Steve Reich, and Philip Glass was a part of that generation.
Yeah, I was going to say.
So there's that kind of, like, they were, at that point, they were discovering, they were playing with one thing called phase music. You know, that gets too boring to explain. But it was basically the challenge of doing much with very little, you know, that minimalist period.
Right.
And then there were other kinds of minimalists that came later on, for example, Arvo Pärt. Mm-hmm. As one of my favorite minimalists, really, but it's not rhythmically repetitious. It's more of these, you know, long gestures. You know,
sure.
Those they're called spiritual minimalists, mm-hmm. Because a lot of the stuff is influenced by a spiritual source. Like for our repair, it's Catholicism, for example.
Okay.
And he has a hymn-like approach to things. And with him, it's a different brand of minimalism. But that's, I think, an offshoot of that is maybe perhaps like John Carpenter stuff.
Okay.
You know, and then another offshoot is techno music.
Right.
And so you can see that it comes from that academic world. There are these... concerts in the world of academia where they're so boring. There are some of these concerts in the 70s where, like, you would go to a concert and there'd be two reel-to-reel tape decks.
Okay.
And the composer would step on stage and push play on both of them. And they would be playing the same snippet in sync. Mm-hmm. And then slowly they would go out of sync, and then they would come back in sync. That would take like 45 minutes, and then you were done. It was like, you know, so that's kind of like, you know, the beginnings of the germination of minimalism.
Right.
And then it evolves to this, you know, these...
Well, the same things were happening in film, right?
Yeah, exactly. In film, what was the...
There was a lot of experimental... I remember this from film history class, but there was films where there was like... it might have been Warhol who had a film of just... It's like 2 hours of a static shot on a Statue of Liberty. You know? Or there was another one where it was just a dot on the screen.
Right.
And then... You're like, why am I here? And then you start to realize that over the course of an hour, that dot is moving around entire into a circle and going around. And that's the film, you know?
Wow.
So there was a lot of those types of things.
Today they would have fast-forwarded that and been like, oh, that dot moves.
Right.
Oh, they would move the pointer
on fast-forward. Yeah. But there's, you know, there was one I remember in film history class that was, it was a static shot on a I think it was called Zoom. I literally think it was called Zoom. And it was a static shot of a bedroom. And over the course of the length of the film, it could have been a half an hour, 45 minutes, whatever, it would slowly, slowly zoom in on something in the room. It was so slow. And because it was in the 60s, this was literally a manual zoom. So you'd have
I was thinking about that.
Yeah, it's like slow.
How do you do that?
Discipline, I guess. But it was slowly managed. Now, the thing that was interesting is that it was mostly nothing going on. But then every now and then, there'd be someone going in and out of a room or something. And you realize, like, something's happening off screen. But there wasn't a kind of a story. But they kept the story, like, just interesting enough that you wouldn't walk out of the theater. Mm. But also just, like, there's not really much content. There might have been a murder that took place. Who knows? You could invent all kinds of things.
Right.
But slowly zooming in and zoomed in on this one thing in the room. Anyway, but I want to get back to this.
To address your the what you're saying. There is a part of music now. I think it started to germinate around the 90s, where we do have something in music called deconstructionism.
Right.
So that's where, you know, again, in the academic circles, you know, there were people that were saying, oh, you know, what can we do to forward our thinking, our conceptualization of music? And so you take a piece. A lot of people had different ways of dealing with deconstructionism. One way is to take a piece of music, cut it up, and rearrange all the bars. You know, like you know, like throw it randomly on another piece of paper, glue it, and then play it.
Right.
Another way of doing it is to record a piece of music with a real orchestra or whatever, and move that through a lot of processing.
Right.
So in a certain way, yes, you know, it generations or a couple generations later, you get stuff like dubstep, or you get stuff like me taking a piece of music and reversing it completely.
Right.
Or you get like stuff from the 70s where they reverse stuff all the time.
Right.
You know, like, yeah. And, you know, just plain old rock music would reverse stuff all the time.
Right. That's how you add the sound of the devil in the soundtrack, right?
Yeah, the sound of the devil. Oh, man, that drove me nuts. But yeah. So, you know.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating. I think there's so many interesting things about that. And deconstructivism is an interesting part because I believe its origins are actually from literature.
Ah, nice.
Right? So it's a very different, and it wasn't the same idea. I think architecture is at fault too. As well as it sounds like what music was doing with architecture, doing a similar thing, right? Because if you look at those buildings, they look like they hodgepodged a building together.
Right. Know, okay. Right? Yeah.
It's not to say that I'm belittling what it is, but it's a little bit of like rearranging and creating different forms out of things. But in the actual literature, it's about literally deconstructing and taking things into taking out all the layers and putting them out individually. Mm. So when you have deconstructed food, as an example, that's actually a much better translation of what deconstructed literature is. You know,
right.
When you have someone does, I'm doing a deconstructed peanut butter and jelly sandwich, and it's like all the individual ingredients that make up the peanut butter and jelly sandwich.
Right. Yeah, I seem to remember that there might have been, I'm pretty sure there was before deconstructionism, there was a period of collaging where there were pastiche or something.
Pastiche, yeah.
You know, so that was, I really couldn't wrap my mind around that. But yeah, you know, there was all these like elements and they came out of nowhere and it wasn't, you know, the piece didn't fit together and there wasn't an arc and it used to drive me insane. I didn't understand it.
Yeah. Well, okay, so I want to, we believe it or not, do you believe we've already gone to about an hour already?
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
It's great,
right?
Wow.
So much fun. But I do want to take a little more of your time, if that's possible,
because
I want to be able to ask you a little bit about some of the, because we talked about some of the composers that influenced you, but, you know, obviously because we're now on the subject of scores that go along with film, what are some of your favorite scores? I know that's probably a hard thing to answer, but you know, some of the things that influence you, like that's something that was important or something that people should pay attention to. Like, because now the thing that I thought was so awesome about hearing you talk about the score of Construct is watching it again with that knowledge of what went into it.
Okay. You know, to be totally honest, I mean, there's, you know, and going back to not branding things, not letting things exist by virtue of their brand, just by virtue of their ability to make you feel, you know, I can't really find it in myself to put one score over something else.
Yep.
There are a number of things I respect, and I respect them for different reasons. It doesn't mean I respect one more than the other.
Right.
But it runs the gamut, you know, from conventional stuff and also non-conventional stuff. You know, like, who doesn't love John Williams, you know?
Sure. Pretty conventional, though.
Pretty well. You know what? Yeah, you would consider it conventional. There are some things that he's done that are like so remarkable. Things that are, you know, maybe not for Indiana Jones. You know, like I don't know, something as like there's stuff in AI or Minority Report. Yeah. You know, you did a movie like Earthquake, which was like really conventional, like back in the 70s or 60s or something. Yeah. That guy's like, or, you know, Catch Me If You Can.
Yeah.
That guy, you know, there's, and if you dissect the music, if you postmortem it, you'll find there's so much richness to it, you know?
Right.
but there, the composers, you know, there's a bunch of composers that I also love. A lot of work of Elliot Goldenthal.
Okay.
You know, oh my God.
What like are some of the films that he's done?
He's in, I think, Final Fantasy VII, I think was his, something like that. Mm-hmm. But you know, he did one of his early scores was Aliens. He did one of the Aliens.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that is very revered by a lot of composers.
Yeah.
On a technical level,
mm-hmm.
if you, you know, it's a score that fits on top of a film, but what he does is that throughout each track, he's going through different techniques of orchestration.
Right.
Okay. And that's something a lot of people don't know, but that's a specific challenge that is very hard for a composer to meet. And
sure.
He sets that bar for himself, you know?
Right.
John Coriangolo is a professor in New York,
okay.
Just like Elliot Goldenthal actually, mm-hmm. but he doesn't do a lot of scores, but he did the Red Violin, which is a really beautiful score. What else is out there? You know, this just too much. It's precisely when someone asks me to list them that I can't list them.
Well, I mean, I understand it's hard. It's like, who's your favorite? When you're a professional in some area and someone says, who's your favorite of that profession? It's like, you can't answer that, right?
Yeah, there's so many people that deserve merit,
sure.
You know?
But so let me ask you this, because I've had this conversation about score in another podcast, one of my Dan Thron ones.
Oh, cool.
And
I should listen to that.
We were talking about the Mad Max series, right?
Oh, yeah. Okay. There we go. Yeah.
Right? So the third Mad Max, the Thunderdome one, the score was done by Maurice Jarre, right?
Okay.
And you know who Maurice Jarre is. Yeah, obviously, yeah. You know, he's done Lawrence of Arabia and Dr. Zhivago. Beautiful composer,
mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Very dramatic composer. Mad Max is a very different feeling from Dr. Zhivago or Lawrence of Arabia,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And we've had this discussion where the first – and the guy who did the first two Mad Maxes, and I forgot who the composer was.
Me too, yeah.
But really edgy music, right?
Right.
It had some uncomfortable grit to it, which is very apropos to what you're seeing.
Right.
And then, you know, Dan was complaining. He's like, I think that, you know – getting Maurice Jarre to do the Mad Max thing is just gonna bland it out.
Right. Okay.
So what do you think about that? Like trying to find a composer's style. I know you hate the word style, but do you think there is enough flexibility in some people that you can see massive amounts of style differences between them?
You know, maybe the right answer to that is like it's like dating. Yeah, you can't really have a preconceived notion of someone. It's really on a case by case basis. And there are some people that there are some people that may only fit a certain thing. They do a certain thing really well.
Right.
There are other people that have been doing this for a very long time and that are adventurous, and inside them are many, many months of studying a particular style that they haven't yet got a chance to flex their muscle at.
Sure.
Me, for example, I've definitely studied a lot of different things, and I'm just waiting for someone to ask me to do something obscure because, you know, there are a lot of obscure ideas that I've yet to exert.
Right.
And so I'm waiting for that. You can pigeonhole. And, you know, unfortunately, I've noticed, and this is like a general knowledge, that there are many people who have a say in the hiring of people, you know, in any given role in film. And this kind of community, what's the word I'm looking for? Committee decision making kind of eventually filters down to like a kind of pigeonholing kind of style of decision making.
Yeah. It happens in visuals too, obviously, and in directing and in visual effects and
actors,
everything.
Yeah. Even actors, like every little thing, right? Like you want to, the temptation is to pigeonhole. And also it's just like, you know, why would you bother saying, hey, you know, composer A, you know, you're known for doing these kinds of things.
Right.
Composer B is
known
for doing...
We need Danny Elfman here.
This person is well known. He's done like three other, or she's done three other films in the same genre. Let's just hire that person, right? Easy peasy. But sometimes, you know, I think case by case, you know, if you jump past the, if you spend the extra effort in getting to know who this person is, they might surprise you. They might have an observation on a genre that can advance it and that can provide something that's fresh, that's not repetitious, that's not the status quo. And that's, I think, the benefit of going the extra mile, you know?
Right. Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think I love that. I find, for example, like I find that Hans Zimmer's stuff is like kind of... There's always something a little bit interesting about his work, and I think it's nice to see that. But then, every now and then, I just like I don't know. I guess maybe sci-fi genres tend to lend themselves to something a little bit different, right?
Yeah.
I think that's something that's very powerful. Obviously, I loved Blade Runner, but when I saw Blade Runner 2049, they did such a great homage to the first one while giving it this whole new fresh feeling that was beautiful and unsettling in the way that it was supposed to respond. I think that, I don't know, I have great respect for people that can do that, because it's a skill set I don't have. Oh. I don't know. Whenever I'm doing something, I'm always trying to give direction to music, and I'm like, I don't know how to even start.
But you know, that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that, because if you just have someone that's helping you, that can do the heavy lifting for you,
right?
And that gets really excited about it,
right?
It's like, you know, it's like all you need is a few drops of water for a cactus, you know, like they can run with it,
right?
So yeah, I mean, it's fine. And speaking of Hans Zimmer, you know, like that guy, you know. Like, look at the variety that there is. Like,
he's a huge variety.
You wouldn't be able to tell, like, Blade Runner could be done by the same person that did Pirates of the Caribbean, or, you know, Sherlock Holmes, or Rain Man, or, you know, what's that, Hard Rain or Black Rain?
Yeah, I remember that. That's the Michael Douglas film in Japan,
that's right.
Yeah.
And he did this movie that no one thinks about anymore, called Pacific Heights. That was like a long, long time ago.
Oh yeah, with Michael Keaton.
Yes,
He was the neighbor who was destroying the house, or he was a subletting the apartment. Yeah, I remember that. That was a good film.
That was a good film.
Yeah,
the opening credits of that is Banjo.
Yeah,
You know, so, you know, who would have thought that, you know, so you know, there you go. Like, there's someone that someone somewhere. Or a group of people somewhere said, let's give this person a chance to do something that they haven't done before.
Right.
And now in hindsight, you know, you have such a range of you know, delicious, you know, composition that goes from one end of styles to another, you know, Lion King to Interstellar, you know, so varied.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. And you think technology obviously has enabled a lot of creativity in some ways, don't you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And you know, not only is Hans Zimmer is someone that has an affection for technology, and he uses it to his advantage. You know, there are lots of people, he's spawned like so many improvements in technologically for music. There are so many music manufacturers that have observed what he does and been inspired by that, and made so many new breakthroughs in our industry that are owing to his process.
Right.
But then there are other composers that are, you know, just freeform, that are not so technologically inspired. Mm-hmm. And they're doing stuff in our same era that is also extremely beautiful. Mm-hmm. So it's an amazing time, you know, where there's so much happening.
That's awesome. That's awesome. All right, Colin. Well, I'm going to try to wrap it up a little
bit.
But where could people follow some of your work or check out some of the stuff you've done or what's a good place?
This is something I'm really horrible at. I have a website that I haven't improved in like over 10 years.
Okay.
So I'm sorry. I apologize about that. But, you know, one day it will be improved.
Okay.
So that website is colinaguirre.com mm-hmm. or colinmusic.com. I try to keep my Instagram kind of up to date. I try to keep my Facebook band page up to date. And for now, that's what I got.
Okay. Well, we'll put those links up there.
Yeah, man.
But I was also thinking,
yeah,
since this is an audio format.
Yeah, thank God. I'm completely naked here. People don't know that.
But since this is an audio format, what do you think about us putting a version of just the score of Construct at the end of this podcast?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so, I will let you know that right now we are mixing it. It's being mixed by the same mixer that got an Oscar or Grammy for The Lord of the Rings.
Really?
Yeah, he's a major mixer. He works with Howard Shore, the composer for Lord of the Rings, and Sliver, and the legend Howard Shore has done okay. Seven.
Right.
Yeah. So I'm using the same mixer who's doing a great job, and right. we'll be ready for that in about, a month or so.
Okay. Well, yeah. Then we'll wait for that to put cool. this out. Well, that'd be awesome to include that too at the end of that. So,
yeah.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Colin.
I appreciate it. It's been an honor to be here in the company of so many other people that you've interviewed. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
All right, man. Good night.
Hi, guys. Just a little post note here. I'm going to include at the end of this podcast the entire score, as I said that we would do on the podcast. And this is the score that is written by Colin without any of the other sounds. It's kind of a unique way to listen to it. But I urge you to watch the entire short first if you haven't seen it. I know some of you may not have seen it. And that's going to be available on the podcast page itself. So just go to chaosgroup.com/CG-garage. And you'll be able to see the page for Colin's podcast, and you'll be able to see the short itself there. But otherwise, you can listen to the sound of the score right now at the end of the podcast. Just another quick note, this is not the remixed version that he said he was going to try to get. Unfortunately, we weren't able to get that in time for the podcast. And it doesn't include the portion at the end, the title, the credits at the end, which was a pretty good, interesting thing that he mentioned also on the podcast. But you do get to hear the sound on its own. And honestly, I think it's fabulous. So here it is. Turn up your speakers and listen to the score of Construct. Thanks, guys.